So, good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you're joining us from today. Just apologies for the voice and any coughing. I'm slightly under the weather, but the show must go on. In today's webinar, we are focused on PCI and looking at some of the myths. As a non-PCI person myself, I've always been unclear exactly where what's in PCI scope. Where it applies to different organizations, and or whether you're not. And it's actually something that I've commonly come across within customers that I've worked with in the past, looking at, with questions around actually which elements of their estate are in require inside the PCI scope, which PCI standard applies to them. And even that view of, well, PTPE, is the answer to everything. And we're going to touch on that at some point today. And also what PTPE is, if anybody's unsure. Now, as I said, I'm a non-PCI person, PCI aware, but definitely no expert, which is very handy because we've got two experts with us here to answer some questions like that and many more, and to really get into the detail. So I'll welcome my guests today that have joined us for this webinar. So firstly, we have Martin Petrov. So Martin is a senior executive with more than 20 years of technical consulting and leadership experience, with a proven track record of establishing and developing high-performance professional services teams. He's a widely respected information security professional, having successfully assisted financial institutions, retail, and service providers, and help them achieve continuous compliance and embedding information security at the very fabric of their organization. He's been at the forefront of the payment card industry, starting with PCI DSS version 1 back in 2005, and established the PCI DSS practice at Integrity 360. And I always mention this about Martin, that he is our PCI guru. He is the person that when we go to the PCI community events, almost being mobbed, superstar of PCI. And then we've got Alessandro, and no less the expert and guru of PCI compliance. He's ahead of our payments compliance practice at Integrity 360, and leads the assessment teams that deliver our PCI standards programs at scale for retail, banking, and e-commerce. He's a PCI QSA and SSF assessor himself, and has helped maintain help many level one merchants and service providers achieve compliance. And his focus spans risk assessment, secure SDLC, pen testing, vulnerability assessment, security architecture, and governance. So, alongside that payments compliance knowledge, very wide expertise in everything to do with PCI and cybersecurity. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen as we are looking to do this as more of a Q&A with our panelists today. So let's set off with some questions to set the scene. So I'm going to direct this probably at both. On a Marta, don't know if you want to take the initial answer, or Alessandro, you can fight it out between yourselves. So before we get into all of that detail, what I'd like to ask you both is a simple question. If a merchant came to you today and said, "We use Stripe, Square, a another platform, we're automatically PCI compliant," what's your gut reaction?
Well, it really says two things. They use a reputable provider, which creates a lot of feeling of trust, competence, expertise. But the second part of the sentence suggests that they probably are a little bit misguided, essentially putting all of their trust related to their compliance obligations in their service provider. That's not optimal.
Yeah,
Oh, sorry,
I have
Alessandro.
same reaction from retail side. When I we use P2P, so we are compliant. I think okay, the encryption is strong, but who is checking your terminal every day, or who verified last person who perform maintenance service? Because those are examples of where the risk actually lives.
Yeah, and I suppose just Martin, you mentioned that they're somewhat misguided. And I suppose it's important to point out that using something like Stripe, Square, isn't a misstep. It's actually that view around what it can deliver. So look, this we probably want to talk about, well, actually, where does that myth actually come from? It's not the payments providers themselves, or are they partly responsible for the confusion? Martin, I'll come back to you again. What is powering that or peddling that myth or creating that misconception?
It absolutely comes from the service providers, unfortunately, and I don't mean to offend anybody or to kind of sound undiplomatic. But I've done some research, and I'm going to share in a moment actually a few quotes. But that, so to speak, myth comes really from service providers who are very eager to sell their products and services and solutions. So their job is to create simplicity, to create ease and comfort. So very often they use very carefully their terminology and words on their FAQs and sales materials to actually indicate that merchants can have a peace of mind and not worry about it because they have invested, the service providers have invested a tremendous amount of effort, resources, money into being secure and compliant. Even taking that responsibility or claiming to take that responsibility on behalf of the merchants. So they essentially present themselves like this super secure vault or fortress that's impenetrable. And merchants need to trust that by default. If I may, I'll just flash one quick slide that I did as part of my research. So I've totally randomly selected two popular reputable providers, Shopify, which is an e-commerce provider. And Square, which is more of a card present retail type of provider, or known with their devices. And I have highlighted kind of the text from their own websites. Here's the links at the bottom for your benefit. You can open and double check that, which kind of suggests or very strongly leads in the direction of, hey, you don't need to worry about it. We've taken care of it. And actually, that's not entirely true. And we have plenty of examples why that is not the case. I hope that answers the question, where
Well,
does.
it does, and I think I suppose it's important to point out or call out. I don't think this is a an attempt or to hoodwink or to mislead or have misinformation. And you say you're presenting as a secure fortress, and I think yes, and maybe this is the question. You can help me answer it. Is it a little bit more of a case that yes, they've invested, yes, they are secure. I mean, they've obviously got PCI standards that they have to be responsible for. But is it that there isn't an explicit call out that you as the merchant have your own responsibilities?
Yes, absolutely. You do. And I think that this can also partially be influenced from the knowledge or lack of the two fundamental scoping principles of PCI. So the first one is what typically everybody knows and is very well aware of. So if I store, process, or transmit cardholder data, then I'm in scope. If I don't, then PCI doesn't apply to me. Unfortunately, that's not true. And in particular, that is not true in e-commerce environments, which use the so-called redirect or iframe technologies to essentially avoid as much as possible that store, process, or transmit definition. But then what they fall into in a category in terms of scoping is the second principle of scoping, which says those systems, processes, or people that can impact the security of cardholder data. So even if you host in Shopify or some other reputable provider, even if you use Redirect or iFrame, you still can impact the security. And you may have largely outsourced some of the technical responsibilities and requirements and compliance obligations, but not entirely, not completely. There's quite a bit of residual risk, and there is also residual compliance responsibilities.
No, indeed. Well, let's just sort of move on. Sort of talking about e-commerce, and one of the things that that you've called out to me is the SAQ A form, which is the form that most online merchants assume that they qualify. I don't know if that's the what they assume they only qualify, but what is that? What is the SAQ A? And you could probably, for me, explain a little bit more in detail. And what is it supposed to protect against? Who generally qualifies for that?
Yes, so very briefly, SAQA is for those types of merchants who have outsourced all of the transaction processing to a validated or PCI compliant third-party service provider, such as Stripe, Adyen, Worldline, and so on. This is for the e-commerce channel. It also applies for merchants who use telephone order channel. Normally or typically it also includes the so-called mail order slash telephone order, but mail order is like pretty much extinct nowadays. So telephone order, we'll leave that aside at the moment because it's relatively low volume, not so heavily impacted here for the purposes of this discussion. But for e-commerce merchants who use Stripe, Adyen, Worldline, Worldpay, Barclaycard, and so on, they basically have been exempt from dealing with a lot of the technical security controls. And I mean a lot, but not all of them. So there's a subset of some, depending on how you count the requirements and controls and testing procedures, there's some 30, 40 or so requirements, actually a little bit more than that, out of the total of 300. And some of those administrative requirements, which deal with the contract with your service provider and defining the responsibilities with your service provider who takes care of which requirement, but you still have some technical requirements. And I'll just name one example. Vulnerability scanning is required for SAQA type of merchants. You want to make sure you don't have vulnerabilities on your website. So this is who SAQA applies, and it's very much welcomed by merchants because, as I said, the total set of PCI requirements is some 300 plus. And if you go for this one, you go down to 30, 40, 50 requirements at the most, which is a massive reduction in effort, in cost. And it does genuinely, when you outsource to a third-party service provider that is PCI validated, when you outsource your payment activities, you do genuinely reduce your scope and your risk and your cost, but not completely and not entirely. There is still a lot of cases that point the risk and the responsibility to you as a merchant.
Yeah, and is that, I guess, the myth that we're currently busting here, or that we're looking to bust, is that that outsourcing means that you have no responsibilities, and are we finding organizations that that aren't either meeting their obligations or that or not following that SAQA entirely?
I think that it comes mostly from the lack of awareness and understanding of how actually that e-commerce outsourcing works. It would be difficult to explain it as good as I can, not using a picture. So again, in preparation for the For the webinar, I have put together just two quick images, two slides to explain what I mean. As they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. So, trying to not overcomplicate and not go too technical, there's essentially two ways e-commerce merchants can outsource transaction processing to a third-party validated service provider such as Stripe or Adyen or Worldline. So the first one is the so-called redirect. And what I have done here is I have taken just a random e-commerce store called Humble Bundle, and I'm kind of at the point where I want to check out. Unfortunately, my screenshot cut off the confirm pay payment here at the bottom of the screen. But basically, I have selected the credit card option. And once I click this button, what happens is I'm very clearly taken to a different page. It's quite easy to understand that I'm no longer on humblebundle.com and that I'm on stripe.com. And this is where I can enter my details. This is one of the methods. And before I explain in a moment what kind of the risk and what the problem with this is, let me explain the other very typical model. So I have chosen some shop that sells coffee online, and the actual website is actually just this portion here. And I have purposefully activated my browser's console to look at what's happening underneath all of this. So instead of being redirected to something that says stripe.com, we actually stay on the merchant's website, checkout.bluebottlecoffee.com. And this is kind of the section of my page where the customer is supposed to enter their card details. Now, the technology that is being used here is called iframe. And essentially, I have highlighted here how the portion of this page that defines here the card entry details is not actually coming from Blue Bottle Coffee, but it's actually coming from Stripe.com. So this information here is kind of a window within the wall of the merchant that is called from Stripe.com. So to kind of focus a little bit on what I'm trying to explain here is the following. In both cases, the merchant's website contains, in its HTML code or scripts, contains the link to either redirect to stripe.com or to call that frame from stripe.com. So the question that I want to ask you, Richard, is what happens when hackers compromise the merchant's website, and they change that link from stripe.com to securepayments-stripe.com? Would an end user be able to realize that? Would they be able to appreciate that the redirect page says something else than stripe.com? Would they be even able to think in those terms? I mean, it says securepayments-stripe.com.
Well, I think it'd be very difficult. And actually, I'd go one step further, Martin, and say, even if it just said secure payments, ignore Stripe. How many people, most people have probably heard of Stripe,
Exactly.
but how many people know what Worldline is? How many, like Sage Pay? There's so many of these different providers. So, in that redirect, are you actually going to know? You'll know you're being redirected. Are you going to know it's legitimate or not? Which actually, as we talk about this, I'm going to question all of my purchases from now on. And but in that iframe example, you've actually got no idea. So, but let's I don't know if Alessandra want to kind of bring you in on this, or I guess the question is, how can that be targeted?
This is basically what also we observe in a day by day activity from the customer side. It's not just theoretical. There are three things that come up constantly. That, for example, which I can give example. The first one that come to my mind is the script sprawl, basically, because merchant add the marketing tags or analytics or a chat widget, for example, to their checkout page, and this is done usually without governance, and every one of those is a potential attack vector, as Martin also explained it in the show. And the most merchant can't even tell me when we do the assessment what script are running on their own payment page, because they don't know. And a second thing is about check your service provider compliance status. So sometimes when we go to our customer and ask, can you give the attestation compliance of your service provider? The answer usually is, what's that? Or we'll get back to you, you know? And this is already a requirement failed for PCI DSS, because there is the requirement 12.8 that asks to store this information and check this information each year from your service provider. And the last but not least, there is the set and forget mentality that sometimes is a problem. Maybe a merchant done their duty a couple of years ago with ACQ, but in the meanwhile, the content management system had three major security updates, or for example, some SSL certificate is expired, or some algorithm that before was secure is not more secure with the evolution. And basically, this is not followed, and this end up in a not compliant and not secure situation.
Yeah, and we're spending a lot of time on this, but I think it's quite important. Can you give us some examples of well, Joe, actually, I mean, obviously, we see, and keep me honest here. There's been a number of high profile breaches. Obviously, we can go back to 2017 when British Airways were breached in a similar manner. Ticketmaster, Volution, Polyfill, .io, and obviously these are all very different companies. But I assume this is the common thread that we've seen in how they're compromised. Not so much about the SAQ, but in terms of that redirect and intercepting the payments. And I suppose there's another part of it is doing it covertly, without the customer or the end customer actually knowing.
Absolutely, absolutely. I don't know. I cannot, and then also, Martin have a good example. But for example, the common thread is that none of them were payment processors failures usually. So every single one was a path to the Fortinet failures, like British Airways and so on. But Martin probably can comment further on this case.
No, really, without going technical, three of those four examples that you mentioned, to my best recollection, they were merchants that were collecting payments for services that they were offering. And it wasn't their service provider that got compromised, but their own website that was leading customers to the service provider, to the payment gateway. It's a little bit like if the payment gateway is the fortress and the credit card information is like the message or the messenger that we need to securely get into the fortress, the messenger or the message got mugged on the way to the fortress.
Yeah.
That's kind of essentially what happened. And with the third one that you mentioned, Volusion, no, not Volusion, Polyfill. What happened is that they were providing some kind of an analytics library for e-commerce websites. So a lot of merchants were using their library, their scripts, their tools, and Polyfill got compromised. So they started injecting malicious scripts on merchants' websites. In short, to summarize, is that merchants who are kind of leaning backwards, relaxing, and kind of, taking a very chill attitude towards the security of their own systems and compliance secondary, thinking that their service provider takes care of this is totally wrong. If memory serves well, British Airways got fined £20 million for this. So it's a pretty expensive kind of wrong attitude.
Yeah, indeed. I don't think that's going to put a smile on any CISO or CEO's face when that kind of thing happens. And I think it's probably important to say that this isn't, we're talking about this in a PCI context, but I think there is a wider issue with, and it comes down to, there's a whole, see, a wider risk issue around third-party risk management, but actually these are third-party scripts, having a clear inventory and catalog of what's being used and assessing them as, particularly where, not so much that you're implementing the script as part of your web application or your website, but actually where you're linking to it as a downstream script that once it's modified that you've got how are you going to
Yeah.
spot that that's changing?
The issue is that this goes, we are focusing now on PCI, but this goes into GDPR territory, and this also goes into third-party supply chain management and risk management and compliance. So yeah, people need to
Yeah.
take it more seriously than we see. And that's why those compromises happen in spite of the fact that organizations rely on and outsource the actual card processing.
Yeah.
But it's not that it's not enough, but it's only a reduction and not a complete elimination of risk and compliance responsibility. That's
Yeah.
it.
So I suppose that's the myth that we've been talking about in terms of scope. Excellent step to reduce your scope, so that you're not actually processing the card data, but you still have responsibilities for it. And as I say, engaging with customers in the past, that has been the view of exactly what you called out, that actually we're using a service provider, so we have no responsibility for PCI, which isn't the case. And actually, that's important in terms of making sure the compliance, that avoiding fines, but in making sure that you are secure as possible. So let's we talked about more of a web-based payments, and you sort of mentioned mail order. We're not definitely going anywhere near mail order, but I think we should get physical and talk about the physical world. And I called it out at the very start, and that it's been fed back when I've engaged, saying, well, actually, very similarly to outsourcing the processing of payments to a third party in your website or web application, that P2PE insulates us entirely from PCI requirements, and we're out of scope. Alessandro, is that true?
Not really. Basically, when a customer uses a P2P solution, generally the customer think we are out of scope. But it's not 100% the case. P2P is an exceptional technology. The encryption is mathematically sound, so this is very good. But you cannot break it. So what do the criminals do? Basically, they don't attack the math because it's unuseful, but they attack the process around it. So let me give you an analogy. So for example, P2P is like hiring an armored car to transport cash from your store to the bank, for example. And the van is bulletproof. So it's certified, it's tested, it's impenetrable, perfect. But if someone swap the van in your car park before the drive arrives, put a fun van that look identical, your cash go into the wrong van. And the armor was never relevant because the process failed. That's what happened when a terminal gets swapped or tampered with, and encryption was perfect, okay, but the custody wasn't. So P2P reduced your scope dramatically, even better than a SAC A solution because you pass from 300 controls to 30 at most. That's real. This is good part of this, but. Those 30 control are not negotiable. So, and they are all about operation. So terminal inventory, inspection routines, identify verification, secure storage, and staff training. That is very important.
And so just following on from that, is the obviously the is the myth that we don't need to apply any P2P assessment to our organization because we've outsourced the payment platform. So is it that organizations think they're out of scope for PCI, but actually they are? Or is it more that there isn't enough focus on those requirements?
It's that they, for card present, should focus on this third requirement. It's very important and they need to be certified. And it's better if you are certified with external QSA. Let me tell you a story that make this real. And maybe after we can see some example. The most common P2P bypass isn't a sophisticated hardware hack or cyber war with nation and so on. It's a person, a stranger in a polo shirt that walk into your store at 2 p.m., look professional and say, "I am from terminal company. I needed to swap this unit for maintenance," for example. And your staff member waiting to be helpful hand over the terminal. The person walk out with your legitimate device and leave the tampered one in this place. From that moment, every card tapped or inserted is being captured, basically. So you didn't fail never the encryption, never broken, right? But was the process that is not working. And basically, you failed because nobody asked three simple questions. And this is something that the merchant really should do and should train the people to do. One is, do we have a scheduled service visit today? Very easy question. The second one is, can I see your ID and work order? And finally, say, does this serial number that you have for replacement match my inventory? So that's it, just three questions, and you can avoid an attack like that. And just let me add another thing that is very important because it's about P2P instruction manual. This is called PIM. Okay. Three things every merchant must know about it. So, first, most merchants have never read their PIM. It's the most ignored document in payment security, basically. It ships with every validated solution, P2P solution, I mean, and it's the most ignored document, that's it. And second, the PIM is your contract with compliance. So, basically, if you haven't read it, it's like you are driving without ever opening the insurance policy. And the third, following the PIM is mandatory, not optional. So if you are not following it, basically your P2P product is like it is not validated. And I don't know if Martin, you can share just a good example that I have about this. It's about a real incident that we have in Maryland that I share with you. Just to make the things more real, and it's important to say because sometimes people say, "Okay, I have my P2P solution, so maybe 3 years ago an attack is possible," and so on. No, this is an example of 2 weeks ago, so seven even skimming ring example. And basically, what happened here? A 20 years old in Baltimore was arrested after installing skimming device on 7-Eleven PIN pad across Maryland. The technique was very easy. So walk in with the two accomplices, one order food and the other distracted the clerk. And then they basically substitute the device with the skimmer technology. The attack have a duration of 5 seconds. And the device stayed there for weeks, capturing every card. So when the police searched his apartment, they found 15 skimmers, 71 cloned cards, and manufacturer equipment. This isn't sophisticated national state egging, as I said before. This is a 20 years old with a distraction technique. And the Secret Service say this is happening everywhere. Last year, as we can see in this slide, for example, basically, they inspected 60,000 terminals nationwide and pulled 411 skimmers. And that's just the ones they found, obviously. So basically, this tells you that a checkbox inspection is an inspection. If your staff don't know what a tamper device looks like, so training is very, very important.
And in this instance, or an example of this instance, does this put the obviously it's there's the loss of the credit cards and payment cards being abused by the criminals once they've captured all that data. But what's the risk for the actual merchant and and by risk I mean comeuppance? Is there a fine for them? Does it I guess how does this play out as something that's going to impact besides customer confidence?
I can answer this in a few sentences. Alex, help me as well. To put it briefly, there's a lot of fines and penalties. There's even a fancy word used, assessments, which is another fancy word for a penalty or a fine. It starts with typically the cost of the forensic investigation. If the customer was determined to be non-compliant at the time of the breach, then there's a penalty for this. Then the goal of the forensic investigation is to detect how many, to identify how many records possibly have been lost, stolen, compromised. And the banks, the issuing banks, will typically go in one of two directions. If the risk is very high, they will have to issue a replacement for which the guilty party has to pay for. Or if they feel that they're just at risk and there's no certain determination by the forensic investigation that the compromise actually was able to access or steal all of these records, then they may be subject to credit monitoring, which again the guilty party has to pay for. A lot of the costs, such as if you were identified to be non-compliant at the time of the breach, have a monthly penalty until you remediate and you demonstrate that you have become compliant. And when you have a loss in the tens of thousands or even more, as it has happened historically, records, your costs can easily go up in the hundreds of thousands and millions. And that's without all the other penalties for personal identifiable information, such as GDPR and whatever other California Act, other legislation you may fall subject to. So it can get pretty expensive pretty quickly.
Yeah, and Alessandro, just put you on the spot. I mean, when your team are carrying out these assessments to help an organization achieve their compliance against P2PE, or and even correct me, is this something that generally organizations will just do themselves? Is it how do you really validate that? Because a lot of things were around staff training and awareness. So that when someone comes in to fix the machine that was never broken and install a skimming device, how do you prove that? What do your team look for? Or is it something that is always just a tick box that that organizations just say, yeah, that's I've done that?
It's a good question. In general, for a very little company, let me say that some company can try to do themselves with the self-assessment questionnaire, but usually this is not enough. For example, before we spoke about that in scope of the PCI assessment, you need to put a system that can impact security. So sometimes when we do some question to our customer, for example, we ask, what is your anti-malware or NTP server for synchronization of the time? And the customer asks, but this do not process the data. Why we're including this system in the scope? But this system are in the scope because can impact security and can impact logging. But in general, if you give to do this by a customer that don't have this expertise, can never think about to include NTP server in scope, for example. So in general, what we do is we help to understand the real scope to the customer, to do risk assessment on this scope, but also we help them with the service provider to validate that the contract are in place, that the AOC is correct, that they have the responsibility metrics. And also we help them providing them good training, because good training is not like to say, okay, let's perform an inspection each month or something like that. No, good training is to show the real case example to understand how you can detect that something has been tampered or substituted and what is the real behavior. And this makes a big difference because, as Martin explained, the fine sit with the merchant because have responsibility. And they have also contractual responsibility with banks, usually, that are written with the smallest possible character in the contract, usually, that you cannot find, but are there. And these a little practice that day by day have a duration of 5 minutes can save you a lot of problems and future problems and fine. And as said, do not have only impact on PCI, but have impact also on other standards like GDPR and above all, reputational impact. That is for me always the biggest.
Okay. Well, do you know, I've although we could sit and talk about this all day, we are approaching time. So I just want to close out with a question for each of you, particularly as we kind of focused on a particular area with yourselves. So, Martin, I'm just gonna, I guess, if someone is watching this now, which people are watching this now, but picks up, if we pick on somebody in the audience or attendees that are watching this and they're an e-commerce merchant, and they want to take one concrete action from this that they should look at this week, what is it?
You're putting me on the spot. Look, just to take a careful look at, I suppose, what is the weakest link in the chain. I used a few different analogies. So you have the end user, their browser, you have the web server of the e-commerce merchant, and you have the payment gateway. It almost is kind of a chain and a chain of events. Obviously, the merchant cannot take responsibility and has no clue or influence on the end user. They, let's assume, have done due diligence on the service provider. They need to look at themselves. They need to look in the mirror and see, are they the weakest link? And as really a final sentence, I think most of the compromises and breaches always link back to the human element. It's not the technology that gets breached. Typically, my experience is that the technology is strong enough, good enough, as Alex was pointing out, to the math in P2P devices. The cryptography is unbreakable for the average criminal, and it just really boils down to humans and how humans deploy, use, or configure technology and processes. Especially in P2P, like Alex was pointing out, you want to look at your processes around securing the terminal.
Yeah. So I think Sandra, I think Martin's probably stolen your answer because I was going to ask you the very same question from a P2PE and retail merchant perspective, so physical merchant. What is the one takeaway that you'd or action you would recommend?
If I think Martin said a lot about this, and also what we said before, like check to do and so on, make a lot of sense. Just let me finish with one sentence that I usually use with my customer, and is that compliance is what you prove to others, and security is what protect your customers. So the best merchant I work with don't aim for compliance; they aim for security, and compliance follow naturally. So the one who aim only for compliance are the one who end up in the news. So basically, my suggest is to aim for security, basically, and compliance follow.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, well, John, we are hard up on time, so I'm going to leave it there. I think there's some great insights, not least, don't trust that person in a polo shirt, as Alessandro called out, and make sure you're putting your cash in the right armored van so it doesn't drive off in the wrong direction. So I'm going to say thank you very much to Alessandro and Martin for joining us. Just before I go, I just want to, and if I can just share my screen very quickly. I just want to call out that this isn't the only webinar we're running. We've got webinars coming up in the not too distant future or very, very soon. So please use the QR code to register for those. The first one that we're doing with, oh, so The webinar we're doing hand in hand with the SentinelOne is looking at how we combat ransomware 3.0. So we're getting into actually what is a 3.0 when it comes to ransomware, and what do we need to care about in 2026. The other thing that I want to call out is that we will, over the course of March and into April, May, and into June, and further into September, actually there, we are running our Security First cybersecurity conferences around the EMEA region and beyond, looking at resilience redefined and securing the human AI era. Well, they're very pleased that we've got through an entire webinar without mentioning AI until I just did there. So, humans are still very much important. So please scan that QR code and sign up for both. Our Security First conferences are, and if I do say so myself, excellent full day insightful conferences where we focus on insights, thought leadership, and very much not a sales exercise. So please come and join us. Hopefully I'll see you at each one of those conferences, as I'll be attending all. So that just leaves me just with the final thing to just say, as I thanked our panelists today, but also thank everybody else that has joined. Thank you.
Thank you.